Hello everyone, it's time for another podcast from theoneliner.com. I, as always, am Craig Eastman, and up in Glasgow, as always, is Scott Morris.
Salutations.
And joining me from Falkirk, as always, is Drew Tavendale.
How do you?
Probably going to be a brief one today, but you never know, we always find time to warble on about something or other. So without further ado, let's crack on. Land of the Lost is a little-known export here in the UK, but over in the States it was quite the hit on television back in the mid-70s. The movie, like the TV series, charts the exploits of Dr. Rick Marshall and friends after they are whisked through a space-time vortex to an alternate universe populated by rusting contemporary machinery, bloodthirsty dinosaurs and a strange alien race hiding out in the jungle. Marshall is played by Will Ferrell, and he is accompanied by Anna Friel as his suffering assistant Holly Cantrell and the ever-reliable Danny McBride as redneck tour guide Will Stanton. Land of the Lost didn't so much explode onto screens upon its US releases fizzle out with a whimper, so is it likely to do any better over here given the relative obscurity of which it is born and a distinct lack of advertising? Scott, what say ye?
Well, I'd almost avoided seeing this on general principle, having only really seen one poster for it, which looked very much like it was going to have Will Ferrell running away from dinosaurs for about an hour. as is a standard with pretty much any kind of kiddie-orientated time travel-y type thing. And it's not exactly that. It's got a few more strings to its bow, but maybe not many. It's a pastiche of classic B-movies from yesteryear, mixed with some very forced, surreal Will Ferrellisms, and with McBride as a kind of side order. Now, when it does work, and there's a couple of points where it does work, the team-up between Will Ferrell and McBride is as good as you would think a team-up between Will Ferrell and McBride is. I mean, Ferrell perhaps has been coasting in his films lately, but McBride is often the best thing in any film that he's in, even in the sort of bit part supporting roles that Ferrell himself would have been in a few years back. However, it doesn't work all that well, all that often, even by the standards of something that's supposed to seem kind of familiar, and it still seems derivative and uninspired and lacking in vision, and crucially, not all that funny. I don't think it's so abjectly non-funny that it's a complete waste of time for everyone, but that said, I did watch this in the middle of a 10-hour flight, and it's amazing what that does to your boredom thresholds. So it's not a film I could actually recommend to anyone unless I was being suitably bribed to, and as of yet, the studios have yet to make with the Doremi, so yeah, I'd say give this one a miss.
Drew, I found myself basically checking my watch quite a lot. It seemed to be, I don't know, it just seemed to be treading water, this film. What did you think?
Well, much the same as you, I guess. I didn't know that it was based on a TV series. I assume it was just somebody had this really weird dream one night, woke up, wrote it all down, and then made a film out of it. It was starting off with a really, really torturous setup as to how they got to this weird place in the first place. That's a terrible sentence, but I'll leave it as it is. And it's just not funny. I mean, I didn't have the same constraints that Scott had. I had the choice of other things to watch and chose to watch this and just didn't find it funny at all, really. With people like Will Ferrell and Danny McBride, you expect there would be one or two bits that were funny, and there were one or two bits that were funny, but that was it. It was just weird, it dragged on, it was kind of tortured, and
Do you know what, for me, the biggest problem, apart from, Anna Friel's just window dressing, and that's only if you consider Anna Friel to be hugely attractive window dressing, which I've never understood that viewpoint. I don't find her all that attractive.
I think it's one mainly for the people that remember Brookside from back in the day.
Other than Anna Friel, I think the biggest problem with this film is Will Ferrell, because unfortunately there are a few moments there where I was looking forward to a good Will Ferrell rant here and there, but there are too many of those moments where really he just sort of goes off on a bender, and he's obviously been left to ad-lib, you know, to his own devices, and clearly Will Ferrell thinks he's being funny. The problem is nobody else does. It should have there's huge swathes of this where he just sort of has little sort of monologues and things and rants to himself that probably should have been left on the cutting room floor, but just clearly nobody has the gall to say, sorry, Will, that doesn't work.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, I don't know how much of the stuff of his in the past of the light he's had any input on. The way I feel about Will Ferrell is that he's a really good comic actor. He's not a comic. And if you've ever seen the stuff he's done in Saturday Night Live, like almost everything ever in Saturday Night Live, it's awful.
Yeah.
And not at all funny, particularly. There's a couple of DVDs available of his best of Saturday Night Live. Well, yeah, which have like about 2.5 funny sketches over 2 discs. And one of the excerpts, one of the discs, is his audition tape for Saturday Night Live. And I'd get more enjoyment watching Taxi to the Dark Side or some suitably harrowing documentary or something than I'd do with that. So, I mean, he's clearly got the skills to deliver stuff written by other people well.
Yeah.
But stuff that he's done himself, I've got strong doubts about.
I think that's a pretty astute assessment of the man Ferrell, I have to say. I have to be completely honest with you, and about after an hour and 10, hour and 15 of this, I fell asleep on my sofa. So,
you've missed very, very little. It ends.
Well, I always feel like that sort of lack of that sort of lack of commitment. I always feel it means I'm not best placed to make any sort of critical judgment. But I'm going to make some critical judgment. It was Boz.
Surely some would say falling asleep on a film is in itself an act of critical judgment.
Yeah. It was, because I wasn't actually particularly tired that day. Yeah, it's just the comfort of my sofa, sort of the gravity of that. Drew me into slumber rather than the sort of any form of attraction between my eyes and my television at that point. The taking of Pelham 123 then. Another throwback to the 70s this week as Walter Matthau and Robert Shaw give way to Denzel Washington and John Travolta in the Tony Scott-helmed remake of The Taking of Pelham 123, in which the Travmeister plays a rather nasty sot who hijacks a New York subway train and holds its passengers to ransom. The original movie was a brilliantly paced slow burner, with much of its running time split between its protagonist's extended phone conversations and numerous city officials bumbling inanely about in blind panic. Knowing Tony Scott, this subtle formula will probably have a lot of exploding cars and or helicopters and or trains thrown into the mix. Drew, would that be a plausible guess?
No, fortunately, about that.
I know it's shocking, but he's right.
It suffers from the normal Tony Scott attention deficit disorder.
The cameraman having an epileptic fit?
Yes, needing to jump cut every couple of seconds lest we see the same shot for more than that time. But beyond that, it's just a very faithful, for the most part, and which would render it mostly pointless remake of the original. It's not quite scene for scene, but it's not a kick in the shirt off of it. That said, though, it's well acted, it's well made, even given the director's lack of attention span. It's just a solidly entertaining film. If you've seen the original, you probably like that better, and you're not missing much if you miss this, but it's a decent thriller. And it's just not that often nowadays, the last few years, I seem to say, there's been too much mediocrity. This is just—it's just solidly good, which is quite pleasing, actually.
What kind of a situation have we ended up in where something just being solidly good is pleasing? I know. That's more of a damning indictment of everything else in the cinema rather than any sort of accolade and taking of Pelham 123. Scott, what did it do for you?
I liked it an awful lot. If you were so inclined, you could actually make a case that it's better than the original film. I mean, the original film, it's a good film. It's well-directed, it's tautly paced, and it's an enjoyable little potboiler. But mainly it's remembered because it managed to attract a really great cast. See also Casablanca, which was always intended as a B-movie potboiler, but just happened to have a great cast attached to it and became something better. I think that's maybe why it's lingered on in the mind. Even then, there's no particularly good reason to remake it. Most of the things that Tony Scott's added are swearing and some more jump cuts, but he has at least reined himself into more or less points where jump cutting is actually appropriate. Sort of when they're transporting Bunny through the town is when he starts going into his usual Scottisms, and for the most part, when it's just people talking, he can manage to more or less keep things on an even keel, which is refreshing.
He is getting on a bit, isn't he?
Yeah, he's getting tired.
I was going to agree with you there, and the first few minutes make you think it's going to be more sort of along the lines of Domino or something, but it is reduced a little bit, these jump cutting there. And yeah, see, Scott's probably right that most of it's not necessary, but more useful and less unnecessary than it's been in his other stuff.
Hmm. And if you look at quite a few of the characters, I think they're actually more complete and better rounded than they were in the first film. The Walter Matthau / Denzel Washington character has a bit more backstory, he feels a bit more plausible as a real character, there's a bit more drama to him.
There's a bit more motivation between him and John Travolta's main character too. It's a nice addition.
And the rest of the cast is just as good. I mean, they may be all wee bit part roles, but Luis Guzman's great in it. I did think John Turturro does well as well. You've got James Gandolfini in what is a really minor role as the mayor. He's just managed to attract a really stellar cast, even for sort of bit part roles, and it does make it a better film for that. If you've got a flaw, I suppose it might be Travolta, who's his usual Travolta-esque, slightly over-the-top, grinning munchkin of a villain. But even then, because
grinning munchkin?
Well, that's, you know what he's, you know what he does as well.
He's not so evil. He's not particularly short, is he?
Okay. Grinning idiot of a film. Is that better for you? Even then, it sort of works when he's playing against someone so grounded and just downright likeable as Denzel Washington. So that kind of chemistry works, plays off just as well as it did in the original film. So yeah, just like the original was a well-directed, tautly paced and enjoyable pot boiler, this is a well-directed, tautly paced, enjoyable pot boiler, and therefore it gets a solid recommendation just for being enjoyable. And what's wrong with that?
What is wrong with that, I ask you? Nothing comes a reply. Mezran Part 1 is a film upon which I have little background information, other than it is a French film charting the rise of notorious Gallic gangster Jacques Mezran, and that it stars France's only film actor this decade, Vincent Cassel. Scott, you care to expand on Mezran Part 1 for me, please?
Mezran Part 1, Death Instinct, as it was subtitled in the one I thought, which is a slightly...
Is that a colon?
Colon, Death Instinct, not Death Instinct for colons. It's not talking about intestines here. So, Jacques Mezrine.
It may not be about intestines, but it certainly deals with the underbelly.
Shut up. Yeah, so, Jacques Mezrine returns from a tour of duty in Algeria and pretty much immediately takes a life of petty crime and escalating into more and more serious crimes under the protection/tutelage of Gérard Depardieu. The character Gérard Depardieu plays, I'm not actually suggesting that he's a master criminal. It's probably of very little use to recap his life story, but in a nutshell, he falls in love, has kids, robs banks, gets into trouble, flees to Canada, attempts to kidnap a millionaire, gets busted, breaks out of jail, does some more robbing, and then attempts a assault rifle enhanced mass breakout for all of his old jail buddies. So it's a fairly eventful life then. The most obvious comparison point is, I suppose, Public Enemies, just due to its temporal proximity. However, this film is somewhat different in that it makes absolutely no attempt to hide what an absolute prick Jacques Mezrine is. He not only is a vile criminal, he's also not particularly bright, as is evidenced by him robbing a casino in broad daylight, where he is well known, and somehow not expecting there to be any repercussions whatsoever, for some reason. It's interesting, at least, in that it doesn't shy away from Mezrine's brutal nature, and because of that, it makes it more compelling, I think, than Michael Mann's recent effort, because that just simply didn't have anything to latch on to. At least here, you're exposed to someone who is vile and makes no apologies for being vile. It remains a pretty compelling look at a violent and despicable man, and it's definitely worth watching. I'm interested to see how the next film, Part 2, which apparently deals with about 3 days in his life between the end of this film and his death, will pan out, which we'll have an opportunity to look at in the next couple of weeks, I imagine. Overall, I did quite enjoy it quite a lot. It's not particularly easy to watch the film, and it takes anti-heroes to a new extreme, but overall, quite enjoyable.
Drew, did you get a chance to see Mezrine?
I did, yeah. I would broadly agree with what Scott said. I really didn't find it quite as compelling as he did, but it's definitely, yeah, the obvious analogue is Public Enemies, and it's a better film than that was, and there is something to latch on to, Scott says, because in this case, you very, very much want the main character to have his head blown off with extreme prejudice, because he's a bastard.
A sympathetic lead, then.
Oh, yeah.
He's a rat bastard.
Yeah, the guy is just a complete arsehole. He comes back from his tour of duty in Algeria and falls into life of crime, not because necessarily because of any horrible experiences he had in Algeria. There's no suggestion of that. It's not because of poverty or post-traumatic stress disorders, because he's bored one night and says to his friend, "Can you get me on some crime then?"
Nice. Crime, man?
There's that wonderfully half-hearted attempt at turning straight later on, where yes. The very first opportunity to go. I mean, the only attempt at giving him some sort of rationale for going so off the rails comes well after he's gone off the rails with that little sequence in the maximum security prison that he's in, which seems to be a cross between the maximum security prison and one of the cells off Cube.
And something from the CIA's recent interrogations of prisoners at places like Gitmo.
But I mean, that is the only point where you could feel any sort of sympathy for the man, and that's by basically torturing him almost to the point of death. Yeah, and even then,
I don't really feel any sympathy for him. It's more just these people doing this are all sorts of wrong. They don't have the right to do this. Somebody's supposed to just stop people escaping. They can't decide on punishment.
Yeah.
And by that point, it's like, well, he's murdered several people. He's probably got it coming.
Yes.
So he's in there because he's already off the rails. That's death after effect, not because of him doing that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's worth a watch, though. It's entertaining is probably the wrong word. You probably wouldn't want a film like that to be entertaining, but it's interesting. It's well made, it's well acted. I'm just slightly concerned about how the next piece is going to go, simply because of the information provided at the end of this piece, which says that this nasty place he got put into was investigated because of his experiences there. And it's always like, well, they're trying to suggest that that was a good thing that came out of his life. There's not really much to redeem him. Don't start trying to do that, but that's the only concern I have, really.
Good. Glad you don't have any more concerns than that. Okay, well, listen, to finish up today, I was in the unusual position last podcast of having been at that point the only one of the crew to have seen Harry Potter. That's unusual given that I hardly ever visit a cinema these days. And not only that, that I had sworn never to see a Harry Potter film. I'm not going to go into the reasons why I went, but there you go. It was a woman what done it, and that's all you need to know. But I promised we would have a catch-up on this once the guys had a chance to see it. So, Drew, what was your impression of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince?
This is probably going to be a bit of a backhanded compliment given the standards of the other films in the series, but I thought it was probably comfortably too the best Harry Potter film yet. And again, the Daniel Radcliffe, every film he gets slightly better acting. Still struggles a bit with emotion, but it's good to see him. And it's nice to see that he's beginning to act a bit better too. Because if you've ever seen Daniel Radcliffe interviewed or anything, you can't dislike him. You're disliking Daniel Radcliffe like kicking a puppy. Yeah, he's just so earnest and enthusiastic and still kind of, but no, in no way.
I would argue falsely so, but
I don't know. I wouldn't buy that. Anyway, he's getting better.
Fight.
Everybody around him typically is a bit better. It's got the normal strong adult cast, and the trump card here is that it's the best Harry Potter yet because it's the most Alan Rickman for several films.
Well, here's the thing, though. I mean, I thought, yeah, I was... I think I mentioned last time I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that I found the young cast to be far less obnoxious than I expected. But having been told about Alan Rickman's character, I was actually quite disappointed. But as someone who hasn't seen a previous film, I expected Alan Rickman's character to be a little bit more sort of dark and insidious and compelling than he actually turned out. I was actually quite disappointed by Alan Rickman in this.
I think the problem is, by this point, he's been a little bit defanged. He was essentially the only reason to watch the first two films. As well as anyone who could carry that dead dog of a film experience, he did. However, in the last couple of films, he's been kind of marginalised, which actually affects this film quite badly, given his role in it. I feel slightly silly trying to have spoiler warnings on this, given that everyone's seen it, but you know what I'm talking about. Yes, there's a few things that it sort of limited him. However, he still is the best in it, the best actor that's present in it, I think. He's still the most fun character in it. It's got the same problems, I think, that the last film had, in that there's just an awful lot of book to try and condense down into something approaching a reasonable running time for a film, and I don't think it's done it all that successfully. It's exactly the same problems as the last film, actually. There's no real sense of time passing.
None at all. It happened in one afternoon.
Yes. It's almost not so important in this one, but I think what bothered me, I think, was the whole point of this Harry Potter book is that it kind of created the whole world, and this is the book that's supposed to be where the world starts falling apart as...
Everything goes to shit, and then the next book is supposed to get it back together again.
As someone walking off the street, there was no sense of that to me.
Exactly, that is the problem with it. It's so tightly focused on Harry Potter rather than Harry Potter and the... To the extent that when the events at the end unfold, there's no real reaction from the outside world, as it was. It's just Harry and his mates. Now, I suppose I can kind of see where they're going dramatically from that, but I'm not sure whether that's what people would want to see. I mean, it's effectively taking a whole world and just focusing on this one guy. Obviously, that's kind of the point of the whole franchise, but I think this focuses a little bit too tightly. However, it's going to have the same problem if you did try and widen it out as you'd have with The Watchmen, where you're trying to condense an entire world, an entire ecosystem that's been created into 2 or 3 hours, and it's not going to work. You've got to kind of pick and choose what's going to make a decent film and what isn't. And given that the books themselves are getting increasingly less filmic, if you like, there just seems to be less of an opportunity to try and shoehorn them into a kind of three-act structure. And that was wrong with the last film, and I think it's going to be even worse with the next 1/2 films.
I know nothing about this. I know nothing about Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure I buy the not having enough time problem, because at the end of the day, Peter Jackson shoehorned quite convincingly the whole, well, at least the best bits, the most pertinent bits of the Lord of the Rings trilogy into, well, after the special editions, what, 11 hours of film?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. How many hours of Harry Potter have transpired by this point?
Yeah, well, it's also the first film, which is, I think, still the longest so far. If it's not, it's only by a couple of minutes. Mm. The first film's the longest, and it's the one that the least happens in, and is by far the shortest book.
Well, so little. Strange. I mean, I know a lot of things. I know a lot of exposition does transpire in this film, but that's the point. There's a fair amount of exposition, but for someone who hasn't seen a Harry Potter film before, there was virtually no spectacle in it.
It's very strange, I thought, because you're right, there is almost nothing. It is almost entirely exposition, and even when given the opportunity for massive set-piece battles, which in the book there definitely is at the end of this film, it's not there.
I thought that was a really odd omission. Because there's no action set pieces or anything. And then the end of the film, in the corresponding section of the book, there's a big old wizardy jewel thing, which you think they'd love to get their hands on. It would be an action climax to the film.
Decided to sidestep it.
People are dying and getting mauled and stuff, and instead the events at the end happen in isolation.
See, this might be the problem with it. It's almost as though they've kind of went, right, contemporary audiences are definitely going to have read this book, therefore I don't need to explain absolutely everything that happens in it. They'll fill it in themselves. If that's the case, I mean, it's probably a decent assumption now, but is it going to be the case, you know, 10 years down the line, if kids stop reading Harry Potter, however that happens? This film is going to be remembered as a sign of the times, rather than anything that would approach kind of a classic children's film, because if you view this in isolation, there's just not enough there to carry it through.
Again, I'm loath to continue to keep sort of prefacing every sentence I do with, as someone who has never seen a Harry Potter film or read a Harry Potter book before. But the impression I got of this is it was just acting as a big staging area for the next two films, basically. It seemed more like a setup than anything. And what annoyed me about it was, like I say, I mean, aside from the obvious potential, I would assume in the book, sort of more interesting stuff happened than just people talking lots. I'm not going to put it down as sort of a welcome comic element to it, which I was quite pleasantly surprised by. But there's bits in there that hint at sort of at darker things that aren't explored whatsoever. I'm thinking about the bit where Harry uses a particularly dangerous spell on someone and,
it's
as far as I can tell,
over.
Actually kills him and then runs, leaves him dead and runs away. And nothing more is made of that. And that to me is flabbergasting. In a film of this length, the sort of teacher standing there having watched him do it, just sort of stare at him. He runs away and nothing is said or done about it.
The bit concerns sort of like his shock and like the danger of like crossing over to the dark side. As it were.
That's the impression I got, is that it was hinting at that, but then it wasn't explored.
Yeah, he does at least in the book get punished for doing that and realise he's...
Well, one would hope so. He killed someone.
He didn't. Well, he doesn't in the film either.
Looked like it to me, but
close to.
Again, there's no explanation of it. Yeah. So if you haven't read the book, you wouldn't know he hadn't killed him.
But the thing that's even more important in the film, then, he does this dangerous spell on somebody, gives great damage to the character, and what he should be is really shocked by it and punished, and realise just how dangerous the powers he's supposed to be entrusted with are. And it's more just, all right, run along now.
Yeah, but this is the thing. I remember in a podcast when we spoke about the last one, Drew, you said, I think in particular, there's a part where a particular character dies and you were quite flabbergasted by the attitude of, oh, they're dead then, and let's move on. And that to me seemed to be the pervading attitude anytime something particularly dark happened to anyone. And this is, there seems to be no sort of sense of repercussion or grief. Oh my goodness, I think I might have killed him. Oh, he's not dead. Oh, well, that's then.
Not as bad. Not as bad in this film as it was in the last one. The last one
really suffered from a lack of
emotion of any sort.
It's not surely given away much to the Harry Potter fan to say that a certain character dies at the end of this. The sky goes a bit dark, some clouds come over and look a bit snarly. They all sort of go, dear. point their wands in the air, the dark clouds go away, and then everybody goes about their business again and sort of reminisces about, it's a bit of a shame he's dead, isn't it? Yeah.
Again, that's what we're saying. I mean, that's the point at which the entire world of magic sort of stops and goes, oh, fuck. And you don't get that in this film. It's just like, oh, well, better go on to the next film then.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, everybody really ought to be doing...
The can-can?
A Hudson in
Aliens. Sudoku puzzles?
Who really ought to be doing a Hudson in Aliens? That's it, man. Game over. Yeah. There's nothing but that. The scene at the end of that with the one snare is about 20 times more emotion than they managed to get in the previous film.
I can't be the only person who, again, having no prior knowledge of this, I was expecting that there's a bit of a setup at the point where Harry goes to a dark cave with Dumbledore, and Dumbledore tells Harry he must force him to drink a liquid from a bowl. And he said, look, Harry, this could get really brutal. No matter what happens and no matter my protestations, you must continue to force feed me this, even on pain of death. You must continue to force feed me this. And I thought, this is going to be absolutely brutal. And Michael Gambon's portrayal of this situation was no worse than the many times I tried to convince my mum not to get me to take Calpol when I had a bit of a cough. portrayal of a man in agony being force-fed something he doesn't want to eat.
Now, there's the thing, though. I mean, I really don't like Michael Gambon much, but that by Michael Gambon was about 20 times better than it was been in all the previous films, too. It's still so much lacking in emotion. Whether it's distress or anger, or
expecting at some point Harry just to pull a sugar cube out of his pocket and go, here, this will help. Oh dear, I don't know. I found that quite chortlesome. Actually, again, that was another anticlimax. But having said all that, like I think I mentioned in the last podcast, I can't really be too down on it because I was impressed by what at the end of the day is a far more solid and well-made piece of film than I had expected. It's just that I was slightly disappointed by the lack of spectacle. I was hoping that this, as my first foray into the series, would be a little bit more spectacular than it was.
I think if they'd tried to manufacture spectacle that wasn't there in the source text or something, then you'd be, well, fans would be legitimately angered. But the fact that there is there, it's been written, and it makes sense too. Because they even have the setup in the film for the manner of getting the enemies into the school, right, which you see through the film. So they've got that set up, and that's how these people come into the book, and this being a special school, it's got defenders, there's a fight, right? And they just say, we can't really be bothered in this film. So there was space for spectacle there. The bits where stuff should have happened, and it's like they couldn't be bothered.
Am I not correct in saying also that the one small bit of spectacle there may be in it wasn't actually in the book, which is the destruction of a particular house?
Yeah, that's been added into the film for some reason. I don't understand where that came from.
And I'm reliably informed as well that that's going to be difficult to sidestep in the next film.
Oh, yeah, simply because that's a significant place for...
A key location,
Yeah, well, it's a place that's special to certain characters in the book, and so it's a safe haven. So they've now destroyed that in the film for some reason. And
I
don't think it will be too important going forward, because there's the next couple of films should basically then be on the run from in the fear of their lives. So I don't think it's going to cause that many problems.
Yeah, it just seems entirely unnecessary.
But yeah, it was completely unnecessary.
Especially to invent something like that, the actual spectacle
could have used.
For all that I've been wailing on it, I still think it's what's his job? David Yates.
Yeah.
I still think it's definitely his best Potter effort. I still like Prisoner of Azkaban better as a film. I know it's less of a story, but I think it's a better film. But even then, if anyone in the world, I know it's Harry Potter, and Harry Potter without Quidditch would be like, I don't know, Star Wars without lightsabers, but why on earth did you waste a quarter of an hour with Ron's adventures and fucking goalkeeping and assorted paraphernalia? It added nothing. In fact, it detracted a lot, because it's really just taking time away that could easily be better spent.
But it did give us a chance to see that crazy, kooky American girl who actually I thought would be quite annoying and who isn't by the end, wearing the most ridiculous hat ever.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Who needs any sort of dramatic impact? What do you mean, the Irish girl? Luna?
Yeah, Luna. Oh, is she Irish? Is she? She sounded American to me.
I thought she was aiming for Irish. I don't know.
Given I think she is Irish, so everybody else that's been cast in the films has been British, or nearly everybody.
I thought she was trying to do an American accent. Well, there you go. That's how convincing she is. Yeah, but that aside, I can't be too down on it because I thought it was a relatively well-made piece of film. It's just, had I not gone in expecting a bit of spectacle, I probably would have been less disappointed. But as it stands, I was pleasantly surprised, just slightly let down on the action front. But never mind. So yeah, what in all likelihood are we going to cover next podcast, Scott?
I have no idea. Mesrine Part 2? G.I. Joe? No, not G.I. Joe.
The Proposal, which I've seen.
Get out.
In breaking news, though, not totally awful.
I don't believe you.
Doesn't it have Sandra Bullock in it?
It's just not completely awful, yeah.
Well, listen, I had to sit through that Premonition shit, didn't I? So, yeah. We all take it in turns to see a Sandra Bullock film.
Is that
here.
Lake House thing too? You know, see that as well?
God, no, I sidestepped that neatly.
I don't know what else is out. Remember. Stuff.
Some stuff. Yeah, stuff.
Excellent.
All right then, well, we'll be back in a couple of weeks with some stuff. Until then, I've been Craig, and Scott, as always, has been Scott.
I have.
And Drew. Drew was nothing less than Drew.
So I'm reliably informed.
Yes. Fare thee well. We'll speak to you again soon.
Cheerio.
Hello.
My milkshake has brought all of the boys to the yard.
Oh, my goodness.
It's very inconvenient. I was going to do the weeding, but now there's all the boys there.
Are you like, it's better than yours?
You're damn right. It's better than yours.
Would you teach me?
But I'd have to charge.
Oh, all right. Well, perhaps I shall give it a miss this week, then.
All right, love.
See you down the post office soon.